Just before that, before we throw your question at, I just wanted, I thought like probably we should have a bit of structure. And I just wanted to highlight a few things, and may not be the highlight of the speakers at all, but I thought that Al-Tikriti talked about, let's discuss and have the question and answer based on some assumptions that there is no conspiracy, no invisible hands, it is as good as you put your effort in, and if you don't put your effort in, somebody will fill it out. So I think those four things are very important, and I think what Lauren Booth also highlighted is that whatever is happening because somebody else is talking on our behalf. So keep those things in your mind when you ask your question. Thank you. Please, brother.
Assalamu alaikum. My question is to Professor Alastair. First of all, I would like to say that I have already changed my image about you. So, go on. My question is that to what extent do you agree that there's a media war against Islam and the Muslim? And if you do agree so, how can you just explain, convince me that there is no invisible hands behind every single thing in this world, in this earth? And if there is invisible hands, how can we, as a Muslim, convey the right message or the proper message about Islam?
Sorry, final question. What was that?
How can we, as a Muslim, convey the right message about Islam?
Shall we take several questions and then come back to them all one by one?
Okay, I think it's very absolutely sure. We'll take three questions. That's sister.
Assalamu alaikum. Basically, the recent revolutions that happened in the Middle East, sometimes they call Facebook revolutions. So this is the new media. And I think sometimes times have changed. And although it's really important what the mainstream media is saying, but how do you think this is affecting people? Because people are now able to log onto the net, talk to people all over the world, and find out for themselves. And in these countries where these revolutions have happened, and they've sometimes referred to them as Facebook revolutions, they've had media that is even more kind of controlled, perhaps, than here, because they've been always told that the people in power are good and kind of been brainwashed into thinking in certain ways. So my question is just about new media, really, and what you think about it. Thanks.
I'll take one more question, and then I'll take the speakers to answer them. Okay, that brother Tony.
How can we can differentiate between the same word that you talk about, that I am taking the same word, but at the same time I can mean it differently? Maybe from the reference point of view we can, because you said that we should have the reference, and the reference might be from the Islamic history as well. Because at the time of Battle of Badr, the same opinion was of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that to defend the mushrikeen in the Medina. And the same opinion came from Abdullah bin Ubay bin Salul, which was the head of the hypocrites. And at the same time, even some time later, when Ali radiallahu ta'ala anhu put the decision that about the Khawarij, and he said that Kalimatul Haq wa uridu bihal batil, that how can we differentiate, especially in this time, that some things are coming from the media, they might be looking good, but how the invisible hand is taking the meaning out of those ones?
I'm going to leave the first question to you, if that's all right with you. I'm going to take Facebook and the new media. I think that major rolling news channels are making themselves an irrelevance. Al Jazeera, however, has just risen in the world's esteem. Right? But it's risen, you know, in the Arab world, interestingly, not because it's a rolling news channel, but because it's giving advice. This really interests me. I just spoke to someone today who speaks Arabic and says, this is what you don't know, is that they were almost conducting Egypt like an orchestra. So, you know, there were messages going out like, you should perhaps move from Tahrir Square now, that bit of the revolution is done, somebody is saying. And they were passing messages, and suddenly people started going to the palace. So actually, its job wasn't just to report, it was to do something more. So I think on the one hand, you've got that we trust the rolling news channels less, because we know that they're split under propagandist lines one way or the other. Secondly, we make new expectations on them. I really hate it when you hear a newsreader going, we'll be taking your emails in just a second. Why? This is news. Everything's become a comment. So I think that's changed. With Facebook and the new media, we have a lot of room for hope here, because it is democratic. You can access it from around the world. It's very quick. It's mostly free. It's an excellent tool, as we've seen. But don't believe you can't be manipulated. I want to send you all to movements.org now. Movements.org were one of the movements that helped coordinate people in the Egyptian uprising. You want to go to the biographies page of movements.org and find out that the leader of it is Mr. Cohen, who's got awards from the State Department of America. Have a look at that. Don't believe that you're free from manipulation even on Facebook. Thank you. Same words, different reasons, different meanings now. Just quickly, I want to tell you this quote from Tony Blair that was used in Monday's Times. The headline says, "The West should not be naive about the Muslim Brotherhood." A direct quote from Tony Blair. In that same part of the quote, he also says, "I don't say you exclude the Muslim Brotherhood, they are part of it. We should not be hysterical and say they are terrorists." So the headline could have been, Tony Blair says the Muslim Brotherhood are not terrorists, couldn't it? Same words, different readings. I've had a lot of problems in my career with headline writers. I'll just give you one quick example. I went to Jenin in 2005, and I met children living in the tents on the rubble of their homes that Israel had seen fit to demolish. I asked these young children, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And mashallah, bless their hearts, each one came to me and said, "I'd like to be a doctor. I'd like to be a teacher." One of them, couldn't have been more than five, said, "I'd like to be a psychotherapist." And I said, "Why?" "To help my people." And I looked at them and I thought, please, God, let them have a chance. Now, when I got back and I filed the copy, I said to my editor, "Look, this is a really personal piece to me. Don't mess about with it. Okay, I'm going to be blunt. If you want to take my job, I don't care. Don't mess about with my copy this one time." And I said, "Put it in writing as well." So he wrote back to me and said, "We're not going to change a word of it." And we love it. It's fine. And I said, "You're not going to change a word of it?" Because I'll tell you what, it was really strong in favor of the Palestinian uprising and what they were trying to do. They didn't change a word of it, but the photo of me standing with those children was on the front page of the Sunday magazine of the Mail on Sunday. A great picture. They were all there around me. I was really moved. And what did the headline say? Which of these children will be a doctor and which will be a terrorist?
I have to say this, that what I said about there not being the conspiracy or the invisible hand is something that I'm absolutely convinced by because of experience, because I was told for so long during my life that actually shaped my career, that I wanted to go in a particular direction, but then was prevented because of the prevalent mindset regarding the media. And then when coming to practice, despite myself, you know, in the world of media over the past two decades. So I would say that the only real invisible hand available in this play is the hand of God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Otherwise, as Lauren has mentioned several names, I mean, they're not invisible at all. You only need to look, you only need to just scratch beyond the surface and you'll come to know who is doing what. We know who owns the media in terms of who owns them, who owns Sky, who owns, you know, Channel 4, who owns the Daily Telegraph. We know these things. We know who the editors are. We know who's writing and saying, you know, I want to be called, or I don't mind being called an Islamophobe. There's nothing invisible there. We like to think that there is something invisible, but actually there isn't. So once again, I would say, if I can, very quickly.
Can I just, you say that there is everything is okay for everyone, but because you are practicing the best, but for the public, they don't know that. Me as a person, I don't want to practice best. I know that there is an invisible hand. I know that there is an invisible hand behind every single thing in this head. So you, I think there is something that we have just.
You see, yes, okay. I mean, I take your point. I'm not, if that's your perception, I can't say that no, that's not your perception. That's your perception. And I'm pretty sure it's the perception of those who discussed with me my career and told me not to go into the media. Of course, that was their perception and their conviction. But I'll tell you this. If there is an invisible hand that ultimately controls everything, then there's no worth in our spending our resources and our effort and our time in this game. If ultimately speaking, someone will, at a particular moment of time, just pull the plug and your efforts go to nothing, I think that that is going to be a serious problem.
Do you know what, Anna, I'm going to have to jump in here because that's exactly what happens. I love that you're encouraging all the people here to go into the media, but I don't think I've ever seen a woman in a hijab in a newsroom yet. So there might not be an invisible hand. I think what you're saying is there's very visible hands shaping the news agenda, and we must accept that. But I'll tell you now, I went on Sky News once with my hijab and I got sacked. Once! I'd been working for them for 10 years, on and off, doing newspaper reviews. The day after I wore my hijab, they called and said, "We're trying someone else out, sorry." The two aren't related. Of course they're not. It's just they wanted someone new. Was that an invisible hand? It was a visible hand. Okay? So I have to disagree. There are times when you will come against an agenda and you are either right with it or you get the sack. And I've been sacked from half a dozen jobs. Or I will find it difficult to write in certain areas of the media, but you keep going because there's new media and people who need to hear the truth.
I think that I would entirely agree with. I mean, Lauren will tell story after story about her coming up against the wall. I mean, one thing that just this moment I've remembered, which I've forgotten for a very long time, and it's the fault of your brother-in-law, by the way. I was in 2007, I think it was, on New Year's Day, I was contacted by Capital Radio in London, one of the main regional stations. I'm sure you get Capital Radio here in Guildford. They called me late November and said, "Listen, we're doing something special on New Year's Day of 2007, and that is that we're coming together with all the BBCs and the BBC Radio 5 Live, Radio 4, Radio 2, and we're doing this one show for about 4 hours, from 8 o'clock till 12. And that is, basically, we're going to select 40 people who represent, in our view, who represent London. And they are going to have a direct discussion with the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister is going to be in the studio, Tony Blair at the time. And these 40 people, coming from all walks of life, representing London, they were. And for the next month, there was an email every other day asking me, okay, what would you ask, and how would you shape this, and what do you think about this? And I was presuming that this was going around with everyone. I had just, well, not just, but a few months earlier, I had successfully negotiated the release of Western hostages in Iraq. And therefore, they thought that I was, you know, sort of a good story. On New Year's Eve, I was transported. At the time, I was living in Leeds. I was shipped all the way to London. I was kept in a hotel, and I was told to have an early night because next morning they were going to collect us at 6:30 a.m. to do all the security clearance and everything. At approximately 12:15 a.m., I've gone to bed. My phone rang. I picked up, and they said, "Well, sorry, you're not coming on tomorrow." And the reason is, well, Mr. Blair saw you and he didn't want you on in the studio. Now, once again, there's no invisible hand. There's no invisible hand. You see, Lauren Booth was the first person, first woman in a hijab to go to Sky News in her hijab. We need another 10 more, 20 more, maybe 50 more to go and be sacked to a turn back until it becomes so much of a tie that no one can be turned back after more, after that. That's what we need. So the message is that we can't stop. We can't stop. We can't afford to stop. I can't afford to continue to give up. Believe me, believe even my friends in the media, I'm someone who has an area on Commenters Free on The Guardian. And I've written so many articles. But believe me, every single article that I've had posted, it has been one heck of a battle. To first of all get it on, and secondly, for them not to mess with it. So that basically they turn it around. So it's a battle that you have to keep going. Because if we give up, if Lauren gives up, then khalas, they do gone. But we can't have them win. And secondly, regarding the words thing, because I think that Lauren touched on something extremely important when she was presenting. And that is the battle of labels. The battle of labels. Never ever, brothers and sisters, and our friends from outside the Muslim community, never ever accept the lazy, the tardy description afforded to people, the pigeonholing. Oh, you're an extremist, you're a moderate, you're a liberal, you're a radical. And, I was told when I went into university, the very first day I was, I attended an orientation speech by the dean, who said, your job is to be radical. This was, now I can't even say that. I can't even say that, well, I'm a radical. Radical is to come up with new solutions, with new ways of getting out of the mess that we're on so many levels. But now it's turned into a bad word. I'll tell you this. Never accept this. Never accept this. Never accept anyone's assumption, oh, well, he's a moderate Muslim. What does that even mean? Moderate according to whom? Extremist according to whom? And I'll tell you this story. In 2005, a couple of weeks after the London bombings, I had a lecture tour of Australia. And before I went out and after the bombings, my host over there said, listen, we still want you, we'd love you to come, but there is a media frenzy about this leading Muslim leader coming from the UK after the bombings coming to Australia. There's a media frenzy and we don't know what to do, we don't know how to handle it. I suggested to them, I said, listen, kill it. Basically, when I arrive the next day, get everyone, all the media who want, to write about me, to take my picture, let them come. And happily, I'll do any interview, I'll do any photo shoot, anything, and kill the story so that then I could go on to the lecture tour for the next three weeks without anyone bothering me. So they did that. And the next day I arrived, I was still seriously jet-lagged. The next day, from 5:30 a.m. up until midnight, I did approximately 34 interviews, TV, radio, and press. I would move from one studio to another only 10 yards on. I would be described in the first studio as, well, Mr. Anas Al-Tikriti, the moderate Muslim leader, and then I would be described as Mr. Al-Tikriti, who's a right from London, he's a radical Muslim figure. And then I'd be described as an extremist. And then, in one occasion, which had me laugh, as a liberal Muslim. And I don't know, or didn't know, what I had done in the intermittent 10 yards to change from being a moderate to being a radical, or then to being an extreme. It's all subjective. It's where people choose individually to draw the line and where I stand according to it. They like me, I'm good and I'm moderate. They don't like me, I'm going to be extreme. Refuse those labels, otherwise we're in problems.
Yes, the person with the short sleeve dark t-shirt.
The media might attribute labels to certain Muslims that are committing acts of atrocities in various parts of the world. But they are presenting facts to the general public. The struggle in your eyes is to have an influence over the media, to prevent them from being biased, and I agree that they are biased as a member of the British National Party. I can say that the media are biased towards certain groups, but what is being done to prevent or to stop
what's been done by Muslims to stop extremists, to stop the extremist part of your religion, your community, committing these acts of atrocities? How will your influence in the media prevent such things happening?
First of all, I want to say thank you very much for coming, and you're amongst people who will respect your rights to speak here, and welcome. Thank you for speaking. Influence against bias. I don't know that I want to influence, but I just don't want any newspaper to be a propaganda machine in the way that it seems to be. So that's where I'm coming from. I know too much about the Palestine story that goes unreported, that I think people such as yourself would be really interested in knowing and have a right to kind of read about. And my question is just, why isn't it making the news? So that's where I'm coming from. I don't actually want to, you know, you can otherwise bring out your own newspaper and give it out on the streets if you want to have a propaganda sheet. I'm going to let Anas perhaps answer your second part of your question about Islamic extremism.
I'd like to second what Lawrence said. Thank you very much for asking the question and for coming. We're all victims of this. When we talk about... I mentioned something which I hope everyone feels that it touches them, and that is that when we say or feel or are convinced that we live in a democracy and that we make our decisions within this particular democratic atmosphere freely and fairly and based on correct information and knowledge, we must realize that when we don't have, when we're deprived of that correct information and knowledge, that we can't exercise our democratic rights. I'm hoping that we all... And therefore, when we're talking about media bias, for instance, and we can go on and talk about social bias or political bias or the such, but when we're talking about media bias, we are all affected. Everyone is a victim. I'm a victim as a Muslim, as much as the commuter traveling to work hurriedly out of Piccadilly Circus station, seeing the headline on the Evening Standard saying that terrorists are going to do this, or extremists are going to do this, or the Islamification of Britain or of Europe, and then walking by, that snapshot again, that snapshot of a second, reading that headline leaves an impression, and it's a story. And all of a sudden, inside that person's mind is fear, apprehension, and hatred against their fellow Muslims, whom, by the way, they may share a living space, a working space, or they may be in the same neighborhood as. All of a sudden, that headline, which to some says, well, it's a headline, come on, for God's sake, don't take it too seriously. But actually, that very second, without that person actually having the time or the inclination to go deeper in reading the article, has created a division. So we're all victims here, and that is the problem. The failure of today, the failure of society and the political class today, is the fact that economic failures, social failures, political failures, ideological failures even, they're all being thrown at the doorsteps of a particular scapegoat. In the past, it used to be the blacks, then it was the Jews, then it was the Irish, and now it's Muslims. It's just the conveyor belt. But it's the same narrative, believe me. I was sat next to Rabbi Wax a couple of months ago at a London conference, and she had, you know, these headlines that she read out. And to be honest, for a few seconds, the first 2-3 headlines, I thought that she was reading headlines about Muslims, about, you know, how they dressed and about their children, what they were reading at school and the such. And then she said, you know what? These headlines, they were published in the Daily Mail in 1911. So 100 years ago, the very same headlines, but with a different subject matter. Now, there is no group of people around the world where there aren't people who take the entire spectrum of being from right to left. You know, you have the loonies, you have the nutters, you have the crazies, you have the extremists, and you have the more softly sort of mannered and the such. Every single human race, every single group, every single human community. And Muslims aren't excluded from that. However, I will say this. If I was to believe, and I'm not, because I don't have sufficient funds to open my own research center, but however, if I was to believe the figures that I'm told by the government and by security forces every single month about the threat of extremism, Islamic extremism, to this country, we should literally have an explosion every single week. Literally. Because if that's true, if it's true that we have approximately 8,000 youngsters indoctrinated into blowing themselves up and killing other people, then it doesn't make sense that we have only had the last terrorist attack, you know, 6 years ago. It doesn't make sense. Now, I'm going to just throw that. However, I'm going to say this. I would rather that we classify people according to their tendency in respect to how they treat others. And therefore, my belief is those who see that it's acceptable or even favorable to kill other people in cold blood, people whom they do not know, have never, ever dealt with or done any harm to, just kill them. That person does not belong to a religion. That person does not belong to a faith. And by the way, I would rather, if we come to that agreement, that anyone who sees the shedding of other people's blood as being something good, sacred, positive, holy, whatever it is, if we agree to lump all those people, regardless of their faith, of their nationality, of their ethnicity, in one box, and see them as murderers and criminals, we'd all be better off. We'd all be better off. And that includes people, forgive me, Lauren, your brother-in-law, who makes decisions to then send people to go and kill people in their homes, in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere, who have done no harm to our country.
Consider here, and that is the BBC wanted to refuse the BNP the right to go on the panel at question time, and I really disagreed with that. If you've got a political party, and we're in a democracy where free speech is available, then the BNP has to have that platform. So does Anjem Chowdhury. But let's not elevate these corners or pockets of our society into larger representations than they are. And one final thing, when the media does ask the question, what's the Muslim community doing about extremism? We do read this a lot in the newspapers. There is another headline that doesn't get put out there. What is the white community doing about paedophilia? Because 80% of paedophiles attacks in this country are by white people. So what's the white community doing about it? Different headlines used for different purposes. We've got to be really careful of them.
Next question. That brother. Yusuf.
First of all, I would like to congratulate Lauren for finding Islam. And my question is that, first of all, I agree that Muslims should be involved in the media. It's very important. I completely agree with that. And media, I would categorize into many groups. You could have television media or verbal media, or I mean, this is how I perceive media. But as Muslims who want to neutralize this perception of people thinking that we are bad people, what is the most effective way in the context of media to neutralize?
That's a very good question. It's a question that I personally ask myself quite frequently, because there is no more definitive answer. But I'll refer you to one brilliant survey that was done. I'm so regretful that, unfortunately, I didn't take stock of the reference exactly, but back in 1997, maybe around 1998, a Muslim organization, it could have been the Islamic Foundation, unless, I really don't know, but it could have been, did a survey of approximately 1,500 people, all non-Muslims, and they asked them one simple question: what is your take on Muslims? And the answer is either positive or negative. There wasn't even a scale of 10. Either positive or negative. Now, at the time, we still weren't in the throes of 9/11 and the war on terror. So, and once again, I'm going to be, you know, not exact, but sort of rough, but it's close enough. More than 70%, possibly around 71% of people said that they saw Islam in a positive light, or Muslims in a positive light. And approximately 27-28% saw them in a negative light. Okay. Now, the next question was, have you ever come into contact with a Muslim? And the answer is either yes or no. Out of the 71% who said that they saw Islam favorably, 98% said that they had come into contact with a Muslim, either a neighbor, a work colleague, someone who they studied with, someone like a friend from somewhere. Out of the 28% who said that they saw Islam negatively, 94% had never ever come into contact with a Muslim. And therefore, I would go back to the answer that we all commonly know, and we're told time and time and time and time again, is that the best advocate is your behavior and mannerisms in interaction with people. And therefore, I recall well that the final statement of the person who was presenting the findings of that survey was, the message is very simple. Go to your neighbor if you haven't already and say hello. That's what's going to sway them. That's what's going to change their minds. So essentially, it's getting to know people, getting to know new people, getting to deal with them. Show them that you're normal. I was once visited by my next-door neighbor when we moved in. My wife did her crazy thing about baking stuff and sending it out to the entire neighborhood and having us scurry around and deliver, and me knocking on the door and then saying, well, you've already given us two plates. So it's because my children are also scurrying around. So anyway, our next door neighbor came and knocked on our door and said, I just want to say hello. And she was in her coat, ready to stand at the door. And my wife said, no, you come in. She said, no, I could stand outside. But my wife convinced her to come inside, and she saw how we lived, and she got to know the kids, and she got to see the portraits and the pictures on the wall. And after a couple of times, she told my wife, she said, you know what, you're the very first Muslim that I really get to know. I know a few people from down the street and the side, but you're the very first Muslim that I get to know. You know what? You're just like us. And my wife tells me, because I wasn't there, she said, I really didn't know what to say. Thank you? I mean, what do you say?
Well, I'd like to, I would have had the perfect answer to this before I read some headlines this week, and that is, how do you portray a positive image of Islam? I would have said, take part in democracy and demand your freedoms, especially if you're in the Middle East. And that would help the press to accept that Muslims want democracy and the same rights as other people to live in peace. But then I started seeing the headlines about people fighting for democracy that America's been shoving down our throats for the last decade. And this is in the Times, written all over it. These were not fundamentalists, but brave people fighting for their rights. Now, why didn't that say, these are brave people fighting for their rights? Why did it say these were not fundamentalists? I'll tell you why. Because there's a bracket missing after that sentence. But there might be. But there probably will be. But they will be if we give them a chance. So, I'm a bit less optimistic about just actively going and taking part in a democratic process, perhaps joining councils and things. However, I will tell you one thing. When you wear the hijab, as I have only in the last few weeks, you are brand Islam. You are, if you want to see it on the front line, I think that's really sad. I would sooner that you saw yourselves as women as brand Islam. When I was thinking of converting, I got the underground one day, and I got it over a week actually, and I was put off becoming a Muslim by the miserable faces of the hijabis on the tube. Honestly, I looked at them and I thought, they must have bad Pakistani husbands who've been in the States. Honestly, these women look so unhappy. So then I was saying to myself, that you work in the Muslim community. They're not all bad Pakistani husbands, I'm just joking. And you work in the Middle East and you know women can be happy in their lives. So I looked again and I realised that every woman in that carriage looked miserable because they were all on their way to work and it was a rainy Monday. But if you were in the hijab, would it kill you to smile? guys, when I go down a road and I say Salam Alaikum, and you go, you come Salam! What nice people you are! But when I see that misery and that held in, you've really got to wear it a bit differently. Please be aware of that. You are your own front page.
Last question for the night I'm going to give to this sister.
Thank you very much for your speeches, they were brilliant actually, and I really highly appreciate the courage and the superpower, I could call it, especially from you, Lauren. Actually, I'm an artist and my work in politics as well as art and politics. And this is concerns me as well. Among the all the resources we have, media resources we have, there's lots of confusion, lots of contradiction. And I get it from my friends all the time that who to trust, who even, you know, whatever they listen to, even Al Jazeera, there are always doubts. Mm-hmm. How can you get the trust of your audience? Or how can you reduce that doubt, at least, of your audiences?
Okay, so while I think about what I'm really going to answer, I'm going to give you what popped into my head. I've got a friend called Yusuf Al-Halou who reports from Gaza, and so many times during the attack on Gaza, the BBC and Sky would say, well, we haven't got a correspondent there and we can't get any news out of Gaza at the moment. It's like there are Palestinians there who are reporting. So all too often our lack of trust is actually race and faith-based. An Israeli reporter, they can report from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, a Palestinian reporter doesn't get the trust of a wider community, and that's utterly racism, and it's wrong because they're brilliant reporters putting themselves on the line. I'm not sure that's the exact answer you want. I'm going to pass over to Anas.
Well, first of all, can I just say that one of the areas, I mean, in the past I used to talk and to lecture Muslim audiences and tell them about how we're neglecting areas such as media and such as sociology and history and linguistics and the stuff, so vital. Now that we sort of have started to realize how important these areas are, now we've come to an array of other fields that we are neglecting, including arts, including sports, including theatre and drama and film and the like. And it's amazing how effective these means and methods are in conveying a message. And therefore, I would, you know, my first message to you would be that I think that what you're doing through whatever strand of art that you're involved in, it's absolutely vital that you make it your objective and your mission to achieve the target of conveying the aesthetic and, you know, beauty of yourself, your community, your religion, your faith, your ideology, through whatever you do. And there is no contradiction between what you're doing, and it's just absolutely amazing. I mean, I was just struck by the fact that you said I'm art and politics. I mean, these two, seldom do you hear them being said in the same breath. In fact, people are told to go to art in order to keep them away from politics. So the fact that you have gone beyond that, I think, is extremely important. But that kind of vision, that kind of objective that you must have is extremely important. And through the methods that you're carrying out, I think it's vital. Can I just leave you all on what is hopefully a sort of positive note? And because I firmly believe, and I don't just say this because it's exciting or it's controversial or because it gets headlines, but because I seriously believe in this. I do believe that we have an array of problems. I do believe that we have an economic problem. I do believe that we have a social problem. I do believe that we have an education, a problem with our education sector, our health sector, our roads, our transport system. The prices are just jumping up like crazy. Those of you who drive cars are seeing the prices of fuel jumping up from day to day, literally. I mean, all this, it's just absolutely unfair. The taxes that we're being, you know, demanded of and such. We have so many problems. But first of all, I would suggest that the solutions to those problems aren't as complex as politicians would like you and I to think. I mean, one time I thought, I was on a public debate with quite a prominent politician, and he was talking about the problem of immigration. And I said, listen, I'll tell you this. You know, one small suggestion, and I'm not no expert on this issue, but one small suggestion, stop fighting wars abroad and people will stop coming to your country. Believe me. I recognize that many of you here, particularly the experts on this, will say, well, that's just absolutely, absurdly naive, or very simplistic. But listen, it's a problem because guess what? Out of the 380,000 Iraqi immigrants in this country who arrived over the past 10 years, almost 95% would wish and dream of going back tomorrow to Iraq. Believe me, they don't enjoy the cold weather. Believe me, they're not here for the climate. They're not here for the... So there are some. So first of all, there are simple reasons to what we are constantly told are complex problems. Secondly, in order to, and your researchers and academics, and you know this, a lousy piece of research is usually based not on the style or the findings, but rather on the questions that you ask at the outset. You ask the wrong questions. A good piece of research is one that is built on asking the correct and right questions. And sometimes, I believe, that our problem stems from the fact that we're looking in the wrong direction. And therefore, when we're often taken, either by politicians or by the media or by various sectors of society, and told that the problem that we face today is Islamic extremism, I fear that we are looking in the wrong direction. We're being beaten by economic failures, by social failures, by all sorts of failures, but then we're told, no, the problem is elsewhere. You have to search elsewhere for the real problem. I'll tell you this. There's a very famous institute called the Pew Research Institute. If you search for it, you'll find it. Its last report, which was published in November of last year, some of you may have heard about this. Most of you, I would suggest, haven't. That research was about Muslim communities living in Western countries. They took about 14 to 15 Western countries, North America, Canada, as well as a variety of European countries and Australia. And they sort of analyzed the situation of those communities vis-a-vis integration, citizenship, belonging, and other factors. They found that out of all the communities throughout the Western countries, the British Muslim community was the most integrated. By far, integrated in British society. Now, the next piece of findings is the most interesting. They found, according to a particular index that they had come up with, that British Muslims were actually more British than white British non-Muslims. The British Muslims were the most British amongst all ethnic, religious, and racial groups making up Britain. Now, this was back in November. How many of us had never ever heard of the Pew Institute research? I would suggest most of us hadn't. And you know why? Once again, donning my conspiracy theorist hat. Because if we heard about this empirical research coming up with such findings, the question would be obliterated out of the water. We wouldn't be talking about why aren't Muslims doing enough to integrate? Why aren't they, becoming more British? Our way of life. Because empirical research shows that actually British Muslims have understood, appreciated, and amalgamated with British life even more than British people themselves.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I just want to say thank you very much. And with one funny story, I remember being in El Arish with a group of British Muslims from Birmingham, and they're like, what could kill a cup of tea and some chips? And then the next minute they go, to be Allahu Akbar. It was the weirdest thing. So yes, integration comes in many forms. Thank you.